Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 159, recorded Saturday, January 25th, 2020. The podcast giving the voice of the traveler more about the journey than the destination. The topic on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast, planning the trip of a lifetime. Coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios in Chicago, Illinois, finishing about 3 weeks of traveling down to Phoenix with one more week to go. It's been a mild winter here in Chicago. For Chicago, I should say, especially when compared to last winter, which is kind of damning with faint praise because, you know, it means we've been in sort of the 20s and the 30s here in Chicago as opposed to minus 23 as it was one morning last January 2019. But even with a mild winter, I still appreciate the 70 degree days in Phoenix. It's a 4-hour flight between Chicago and Phoenix. I normally enjoy that amount of unplugged time just to read, listen to music, listen to podcasts. But a couple of weeks ago, I tweaked my back during a workout. Not a big thing. Done it many times before. But this time, the pain didn't go away. It's hung around on my left side, moving around from my back to my hip to my thigh, making it very uncomfortable to sit for long periods of time, like 4 hours, which has made me notice how long U.S. carriers keep the fasten seatbelt sign on, like forever. By the time that seatbelt sign finally goes off, my back is just screaming, and the person next to me in the middle seat is probably pretty annoyed at my constant shifting. Back in episode 152, I talked about Southwest flights between Chicago and Nashville that we were taking that kept the seatbelt sign on for the entire hour and 20-minute flight. I mean, it hasn't been that bad on these flights to and from Phoenix, but it's easily been 45 minutes. And it isn't just Southwest. United is doing the same thing. Quite a difference from, say, when Andrew and I flew Air Baltic back in October. 10,000 feet and bing, that seatbelt sign would go off, and we'd still be climbing. Now, it doesn't need to turn off that fast, but there's got to be a happy medium there somewhere. Actually, with the mild winter and, quite honestly, a little bit of luck, my flights to and from Phoenix have been pretty dependable. Except for this week. On Monday, I started getting delay notices for my United 7:40 p.m. flight. I started getting them right after lunch. So I was starting to get delay notices 7 hours before my flight left. And United was doing their typical rolling delay exercise. It's 30 minutes. No, really an hour. No, now we're leaving at 9 p.m. Not just kidding. It's really 9:40 p.m. I was okay with the 30 and the 60-minute delays, but when I would get two more delay notices in a 40-minute span, now something's up. So I call United, I get the Premier desk, which the guy tells me he's in Chicago too. I tell him the story. Look, rolling delays have now gone to 2 hours. I don't trust that this flight is actually going to go off, and I need to get to Phoenix tonight. The guy says, yep, I got it. Makes sense. He tries to find me routings through LAX and San Francisco, but the connections just don't work. So he cancels and refunds my ticket. No hassles, no questions, no change fee. I love this guy, but I still can't spend any money on United for this one. So I pivot to Southwest and American, which both have 8:40 flights. I look at American seat map, nothing but middle seats. That's just not going to work with my back. So it's over to Southwest. I'm A-list, so I know with their open seating, I'm going to get an aisle seat. There you go. I tell you, I haven't done this dance in a while, so I am a bit out of shape. But with one more trip to Phoenix left, I have to tell you, I'm not looking to get back into the flight dance shape. So following up, before writing a podcast, I go through all the Travel Commons interaction channels, website comments, Facebook comments, Instagram comments, Twitter replies, emails, and inevitably I miss something, which I've done since October. when Arnold Heines and I traded Twitter direct messages. So, boom, missed that channel. But Arnold and I, we were trading DMs about travel converters. In episode 155, I talked about having to sort of rummage around for European plug adapters before my Krakow and Budapest trip, and how I'm always just leaving these things behind. And Arnold wrote, "Hi, Mark. Just caught up with your last two episodes. I also did the travel converter dance until someone recommended the Power Bagel. It's so small and comes in handy not only as a travel adapter, but also in hotel rooms with not enough power plugs, conference tables with one outlet, etc. You know, it never leaves my bag, so I thought I'd share." Arnold, a very belated thanks, and I apologize for not featuring this and not talking about this sooner, because it's a really good recommendation. Because I clicked through the link that Arnold sent, and the Power Bagel is a compact circular power strip of universal plugs. So they'll take, you know, UK, European, American, whatever. And then it's got a couple of USB ports. They say that the circular design keeps large power adapters like the old, MacBook power supply and actually the new ones, keeps them from blocking outlets like they would do on straight power strips. And then in the center hole, they store a universal plug adapter so that you can plug the Power Bagel into most international outlets. It's actually a very cool design, and in the DM stream, Arnold really vouches for it. Clicking around that website, the company Mogix, M-O-G-I-C-S, butchering that name. It looks like they're a three-person design company based in Singapore and outsourcing their electronics manufacturing to China, like everybody does. They got started a few years ago on Kickstarter and actually are now in the middle of a new campaign for an upgraded version of the Power Bagel called, of course, the Super Bagel. It looks like, from reading it, the Super Bagel upgrades that plug adapter that fits in the middle, and then it adds what I'll call the on-trend USB-C port. Kickstarter says the campaign ends on February 25th, so if you're listening to this beforehand and interested in it, I'll include a link in the show notes so that you can find it. Kickstarter seems to be the place for these things. I sent Arnold a link to the travel adapter campaign that I joined. The Passport Go power adapter is a more traditional travel adapter. It's a big cube. It's actually like a handful that'll plug into most international outlets and has three USB-A, kind of the older, the more traditional USB outlets, and then one on-trend USB-C plug, and then also in the back of it, kind of a universal plug adapter. So again, you can plug a UK, European, US, you know, kind of the Australian twisted blades. Any of those plugs will go in. I use this Passport Go. Actually, Andrew and I both got them, and we use them on the Baltics trip in October. And I have to tell you, for personal travel, I've found that most of my travel needs now seem to be driven by USB cords rather than plugs. So my iPhone did a rapid charge off the USB-C port, my tablet and headphones off the USB-A ports. And since I don't have enough hair to justify a blow dryer, let alone a curling iron, I actually never used the plug receptacle. Indeed, if I had brought my MacBook Air, I could have powered that one off that same USB-C port rather than bringing its separate power adapter. I'll also include a link to their Kickstarter page if anybody's interested. Now, back in episode 156, I talked about how I really liked electric scooters, using them to run around in Chicago and Charlottesville, Virginia, D.C., and then most recently down here in Phoenix. And whereas Chicago wrapped up their e-scooter pilot in October, which made sense, I don't think those scooters would do real well in snow, Phoenix seemed, at least to me, the perfect place with the perfect weather. No snow, not a lot of rain. And they seem to have nailed one of the main problems with electronic scooters, these e-scooters. People leaving them lying everywhere, especially in the middle of sidewalks. In downtown Phoenix, you have to park them in designated areas, typically near sidewalk corners, inside a painted box. So it surprised me when I started coming down here in December that I saw only two scooter companies in downtown Phoenix, Lime, which is partnered with Uber, and Spin, which is now owned by Ford Motor Company. But then a couple of weeks ago, Lime announced that they were pulling out of Phoenix. They said they couldn't make any money. And actually a day or so later, all their scooters were gone. I don't know what the right balance between scooter availability and public right-of-way is, but I have to tell you, I hope Chicago and Phoenix and other cities can figure it out. This whole micro-mobility space, bike shares, e-scooters, I think it's an important part of the urban transit mix. And when the weather's nice, they're fun, too. In that same episode, 155, I talked about buying a smaller bag, the Travel Pro Max Lite 5 International carry-on size, to meet the smaller carry-on size and weight requirements of Air Baltic, which Andrew and I would use to hop between Riga, Tallinn, and Helsinki on our Baltic's beer and sauna tour. I said back then that I didn't want to spend a lot of money on it because I'd only be using it for that Baltic's trip and then maybe some short couple-of-day trips, and that my big Victorinox 22-inch bag would remain my primary bag. But as it turns out, I've been using that smaller Travel Pro for these four-day, three-night trips to Phoenix. Now, with temperatures in the 70s, I'm not having to bring big, heavy, thick clothes with me, but still, I've actually been pleasantly surprised by what clothes I can get into that smaller Travel Pro. But I think I'll be back to the Victorinox this coming week's trip. I'm vectoring through Durango, Colorado for a ski weekend on the way home. A little colder, a little more clothing. I think I'm going to need all the space I can get. And hey, if you have a travel story, questions, comments, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file, comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page to the Instagram account at Travel Commons, or you can post your comments on the website at travelcommons.com, and I promise that I won't forget them. The topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is planning the trip of a lifetime. You know, we've talked on past episodes about trip planning, using guidebooks, social media, Google algorithms, shooting the gaps between bipolar TripAdvisor reviews, I don't know, casting runes, consulting tarot cards, and all that for a week's vacation or maybe two. Well, what about a 9-week vacation, a paid sabbatical that you've worked and waited 7 years for? Well, that's the extreme trip planning that longtime Travel Commons listener and even longer-time friend Alan Marco and his wife Chris Chufo faced last year. And with January being a big travel planning month, I asked Alan to talk to us about how he and Chris planned for their trip of a lifetime. Alan, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Alan, it's interesting that we have this conversation, and this is the January episode, because a lot of folks in January start to make plans.
Yeah, it was a year ago. We left 2 days after Christmas, so we were gone from December 27th to February 27th, 2019. I'm getting daily reminders from Facebook.
So give us a little bit of background on the trip. It was a sabbatical. How long was it? What were some of your thoughts on it?
Well, her company allows, after 7 years of employment, you can take a chunk of time off. In the case of her company, you're allowed to take a number of weeks off. And if you take it at a certain time of year, the Christmas holidays, you can get an extra week. And you can clamp on 2 weeks of vacation. So that would give us a total of 9 weeks, which was a very attractive option to take that much time off in one chunk, never having done anything longer than a 3-week vacation.
9 weeks, trip of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. There's two sides of that. One is, wow, that's pretty exciting. The other side of that is, wow, what am I going to do? And how do I start to wrap my head around it?
Yeah, it's like, it's exciting to think about it first, and then it's kind of daunting to think about. It's kind of like, it's this huge thing to plan. It's a mountain to climb. It's just almost overwhelming when you start thinking about all the details that you're going to have to figure out.
So unpack that. How did you start to climb that mountain?
We decided that we really wanted to do one big chunk of time. Like you said, trip of a lifetime is a really good way to put it, because that's how we were thinking about it. We're also thinking about, let's go someplace we haven't been before. We wanted to do something that would be more difficult to do when we're older, when we're retired. And we like warm weather vacations. So knowing we had to take it during the holiday time to get the advantages of those extra weeks, we decided that it's kind of naturally pointing towards Southeast Asia for us.
So at least that sort of narrowed it down to a quarter of the globe, right?
Yeah, and it's also like, where could we go for that much time, right? And mm-hmm. So you've got to lace a few destinations together. And through our planning, it kind of even made more sense to go through adjacent countries in Southeast Asia.
So now we've got it. We've gone from a complete blank slate to at least an area. So after you've got it narrowed down to an area to Southeast Asia, what was your next thought process? So how did you then begin to sort of piece the details together?
Yeah, we definitely had like a hit list of countries who wanted to visit. We knew we wanted to go to Vietnam. We knew we wanted to spend some time on the beaches in Thailand. And speaking with some good friends of ours who have traveled extensively and lived for many years at a time in that part of the world, we had a few meetings with them where we did some brainstorming. Also, in part of my research, I found an itinerary. I mean, there's a ton of information available online. I kept coming back to a reference to banana pancake route that a lot of backpackers took. And it's kind of this classic route through Vietnam and Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand.
So banana pancake route. Is that just the shape of the route? Or is there a pancake house somewhere that...
I think I looked that up originally, and I can't remember why it has that name now that I think about it.
But
it's quite interesting. I basically took that and modified it to our further discussions with our friends and between Chris and I. Mm-hmm. Some things we weren't really interested in. We didn't have enough time to do the complete routing. There were certain things I didn't want to do, which was spend several days getting from like Siem Reap in Cambodia into northern Thailand. I didn't want to take bus travel. It was pretty primitive routing. So there were certain things we opted to fly mm-hmm. rather than take a bus, say, things like that. Like where a normal backpacker would take it, we're going to be adults backpacking.
Yeah.
wanted a little bit higher level of comfort.
There is a difference between your 20s and your 50s, I think, with a travel standpoint.
Although we did want to take everything. We wanted to travel with everything on our backs. We actually carried like 40-liter backpacks on our back and 20-liter backpacks carried on the front.
How did that work for you guys?
It was great. It was hard to get used to at first, but it's very efficient when you're traveling. Part of that is you can carry everything on. When we were taking flights, it just gives you a lot of freedom. You're kind of in control of your own destiny, so you don't have to deal with the lost luggage kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a major concern when you're that far away from home, losing everything.
Well, also, I think if you're doing point-to-point travel, that also can be a challenge, because even if you lose something, somebody finds it, getting it caught up to you can
right.
be a challenge.
As we were packing when we were leaving the U.S., I started thinking about the luggage tags, you know, and we had luggage tags on our bags, of course, but we also had them inside the bags. And I started thinking, it's not going to help to have my home address on that and my home phone number, because if it gets lost somewhere in Southeast Asia, they're not going to be able to get a hold of me. So I printed out our first set of our hotel address and the phone number of the hotel and their email address and my email address. So as we progressed along the way, we had kind of this ritual breakfast the morning of we were leaving. We would redo our luggage tags with the information of the destination we were going to that day. So it got lost somehow in transit. It knew where to find us, right? They knew where to find us. It's kind of like thinking about the old steamer trunks that were on ocean liners, they always had the destination, not the home address.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a good insight. Two questions. Was there some things you packed that really, in hindsight, you didn't need? And then the flip side of that, were there a couple of things that you said, wow, I really wish I had packed that?
When you're only bringing that much stuff, which isn't that much for 8 weeks, you've got to think through a few things. You've got to justify everything that you put in that pack. We knew in advance we were going to be going to a cold weather location in Hanoi that time of year. It could be in the 40s, low 50s, and we ended up bringing some light down jackets and base layers that we typically use for skiing, things like that. Never having been to Hanoi before, once we got there, you can literally buy any of that stuff on the streets for $5, you know, and it would have been something where you just buy it there and leave it there. But we had spent considerably more money on that, or we brought some of our, you know, ski base layers with us that took up valuable space when we didn't need to do that.
Yeah. Flip side of that is, was there something that you didn't have that you said, damn, I wish I had that, and that you couldn't buy?
Yeah, right. You can't buy your way out of the jam, right?
Yeah.
We have never said that, and I don't remember saying that during the trip, that we ever wished we had something that we didn't have. I got to tell you, there was a lot of thought put into the packing.
Yeah.
Multiple use, you know, whether it be pants or shirts, you've got to make sure almost everything is compatible with everything else. So you kind of keep it to a limited color range, a lot of black, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm a big fan of black.
Yeah.
It goes with everything and it doesn't show stains real well.
Right. And a lot of wool clothing, the 72-hour wool t-shirts, just a lot of, we were going to be in very, very hot, humid climates for most of the trip. And we brought a lot of things that we could wash in our hotel. But also when you get to Southeast Asia, hotel laundry is very inexpensive. So there were a couple of times where we just would send our entire backpack's worth of clothes out. It was literally like $5 to get it all cleaned, you know.
I had that same experience when we went to Vietnam. We went in July. It was just like hugely hot. We did exactly the same thing. It was like, you know, let's ship all this stuff. We took it across. So yeah, it was probably about $3-$5. Everything came back amazingly clean, but amazingly stiff. Like they had just beat the hell out of it.
Yes, they did something. You know, and we'd be in Thailand on an island after we just sent our laundry out, and you're driving down the street, and there's some garage that you see all this, three industrial washers and all these clothes hanging on a line. It's like, I wonder if that's our stuff.
You didn't recognize your underwear. Or
yeah,
anything.
No.
I guess that's
but
a
yeah,
thing.
It's like, you know, you're going away for 8 weeks. You certainly can't bring, you know, that many pairs of underwear. You know, you're going to be doing laundry in the hotel room sink, and you've got to plan accordingly.
Right. You know, when you were planning this, so you sort of, you know, where you're going to want to go. You said, okay, look, you know, I've got a set of places that I want to see. I've got some sort of structure, some sort of sequence that other folks have done, so it sort of makes sense.
Yeah.
So the next step then is, how much travel did you book ahead of time versus how much was just sort of ad hoc, you sort of let flow?
Yeah, and we thought about this a lot before we left. And deliberately, we decided we wanted to have our travel booked for our outbound and inbound, mm-hmm. So the beginning and the end of the trip. I wanted to use miles for business class seats, but in between, we decided we just wanted to keep some flexibility to the trip and book as we went. And okay. That was, being people that are really focused on details, that was kind of an interesting challenge for us to kind of let go like that. And in the end, it was very liberating to do it that way.
Did that ever catch you anywhere along the way?
We talked that through before we left, and we decided that might be the price we pay to keep flexibility. You know, there were plenty of places to stay. There was one accommodation in Thailand where we actually booked the last room that was available. But it did work to our advantage a few times, not having booked in advance, because as an example, when we were on a cruise in Ha Long Bay in Vietnam, our next destination was going to be the Central Coast. And some folks that we were traveling with on the same cruise, we're chatting them up, and they told us that they had just come from that area, and it was just torrential rainstorms. Mm-hmm. and we looked at the weather. It was going to be that same way for a week or so. So we decided to just avoid that part of the country, and we just flew directly to Ho Chi Minh City, Saigon, instead. So there were a couple of things like that where our initial thoughts on itinerary, we kind of decided to reroute.
Well, that makes sense.
And so then when we had our routing kind of loosely established, we would just spend a night every few days doing our advanced booking. So I would always try to stay two steps ahead, about a week in advance. Sometimes your first choice accommodation would open up. You know, we just were very loose that way. You know, we were covering a lot of ground. And one of the major things I kind of realized as we were going is even though we had 8 weeks, it was still a limited time to see what we wanted to see. So I kind of determined that we didn't want to spend more than like a half a day transiting, if at all possible, between destinations. So like I was saying earlier, instead of taking a 2-day bus ride where you'd be in the middle of nowhere, we would just fly that, you know, and gain some time, given the fact that in Southeast Asia, flights are very inexpensive, and there's lots of flights going everywhere.
Was there a certain airline that you tended to use there? Was there one, or did you just tend to use the national carriers?
I would do reviews of the national carriers and their safety records and things like that. At the beginning of the trip, I was trying to use Vietnam Airlines. Mm-hmm. They had fairly decent record, and they covered a bunch of the first couple of countries we were in. When we got into Thailand, Thai was easy enough to use, and their Star Alliance. So I've got a lot of United miles. So I stay on that wherever possible. And also the type of plane they were flying. I didn't want to take a lot of regional jets if we could avoid doing that.
Probably, actually, that probably makes it easier from a carry-on standpoint also.
Yeah, exactly.
Any visa issues that you had kind of hopping between countries, or did you line those all up before you left?
I did a lot of research on visas, and we had to get our visa before we left for Vietnam. We did that here in San Francisco. They give you a lot of options. I also decided to do a 2-entry exit visa for Vietnam. You know, you kind of never know what's going to happen when you're in these countries that far away from home. And I wanted to basically have a way out if we had to exit into another country for whatever reason, political unrest or who knows what, typhoon, storms, whatever. So I had the availability to go back into Vietnam, which I thought would be fairly easy to get back to the U.S. from, should we have to do something like that.
Oh,
it cost a little more, but I thought that was a good insurance policy to have. Most of the visas that we needed, we could just obtain upon arrival. Again, I did a lot of research to make sure that was the case.
How much time do you think you invested in planning, all told?
We knew we had a deadline as far as we knew what year we had to take the trip. And I knew in advance that I wanted to book our airline reservations for the business class seats approximately a year ahead of time. We were researching this trip for about 18 months. There's a lot of research that goes into figuring out how long you spend in each place. And I found that had to be managed as we were going along. I kind of thought about what we wanted to see. We talk about how long we wanted to spend in certain places. And there weren't a lot of times where we said, I wish we had an extra day here, because we had done that kind of legwork in advance and we did the homework. But that comes with the time and the planning.
Well, Alan Marco, thank you very much. Thanks for sharing those stories with us on the here on the Travel Commons podcast. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks for having me. It was great to take the opportunity doing research just for this podcast to go through my old notes. And again, it was a year ago, and it's just bringing back a lot of great memories.
Okay, that's it. That is the end of Travel Commons podcast number 159. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Thanks again to Alan Marco for taking the time to be with us. And actually, just for a quick pointer, I want to point everybody back to the very first Travel Commons video, which actually was about my own trip to Vietnam back in 2010. I'll put a link in the show notes if indeed if anybody wants to go back to the Wayback Machine. Also, check out the show notes for music links. You can always find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Alexa, iTunes, Spotify. Just say, Alexa, play Travel Commons Podcast. The links along with the RSS feeds are on the right-hand side of the Travel Commons website under the heading Subscribe. Right below that in the social media section are links to the Travel Commons Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. If you're already subscribed, I really appreciate everybody and anybody who leaves us a review on one of these sites. And as always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file, comments, COMMENTS at TravelCommons.com, and Peacock on Twitter, write them on the Travel Commons Facebook page, on the Travel Commons Instagram site, or on the website at TravelCommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, even direct messages like Arnold, and post comments on the website. And until that next episode, take care, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.